Jeff.
Hello, Soraya. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Are you excited for this week?
I am super excited for this week. This is gonna
All
be
right.
fun. I'm excited
This is
because we have guests and the topic. I'm excited about both, the guests that we're having and the topic.
All right, so why don't you tell folks who our guests are?
All right, so we invited a couple of our good friends and returning co-hosts on the show, guest co-hosts. And that is Joy and Howie. So we had them on. Joy's been on a couple times, but we had Howie on to talk about the last show that we did.
Remember live shows.
Barely, barely.
What's our topic this week, Jeff?
So we're going to talk about compilation albums that have been really important to us. And I want to talk a little bit more about compilations in general, but I say we give these guys a call and we'll talk about it all together.
Let's hop into it. Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme,
a podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, agrubiar.
Let's get groovy. 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 All right, time to call Howie and Joy.
Hello,
Hello, Joy. How are you?
can you see me?
Not yet.
No? What do I do?
You gotta turn on your webcam. Hey, Howie!
Hey, man.
Hey there.
We're just waiting to see Joyce.
My super.
It worked.
It works.
It works.
You all have glasses on. Should I?
We all look chic. Hey Jeff, so once again, as we let our as we teased at the top of the episode, we're talking about compilations. Why compilations, Jeff?
So I was thinking there's a couple different kinds of compilations. There's band compilations, kind of like greatest hits or best of, where you have a compilation of just one particular band. And then we have the type of compilations that we're going to be talking about over the next few weeks, where it's compilations that include multiple bands, so various artist compilations. And I think the four of us have already talked about there's been some pretty important compilations that have made big impacts on our lives. So that's what we're going to talk about. That type of compilations.
So I just want to start out with a beginning question for all of us. And Howie, I'm going to start with you. Why is Wharf Rat Tales an important compilation for you? We've all talked about this one at some point in time, but share with our listeners, why is this an important compilation for you?
It's actually one of the first compilations I really was exposed to that I came across. At that time, I was just kind of getting into music scenes from just around the country and around the world. And so, to me, I'm up here living in Seattle, and Seattle had a pretty cool music scene. But what was going on in LA and Boston and some other towns around the country just were really cool to me. And here's this record that has all these bands and all these cool songs from this amazing scene, and it just kind of blew my mind because it's all these songs that and bands that I just everything was new to me and it was all in one place. It was really cool.
That's perfect. What about you, Joy? Why is Wharf Rat Tales so important for you?
Okay, well, full disclosure, I was given this on vinyl, this and a question single, in hopes of convincing me to go on a blind date with Tony Rugolo.
Get out of here.
Yeah. So
See, that's a player move. That's a player move, by the way.
Right.
My latest single.
And I'll give a shout out to Billy Glasser for that, because he was the go-between. But anyway, and so I listened to it, and just it was so different than anything else I had heard. Really at the time, it was like an album. It wasn't, I didn't have exposure to that kind of a compilation really before, where it was a bunch of bands and local bands at that, because I was at UCLA at the time. So some of the names I already knew and some I didn't. And I just fell in love with it. That vinyl is one of my prized possessions.
I believe it. Shoot, man. And I love the story that goes with it. It's got history.
Yeah. It has major history.
I love it. Jeff, what about you? Why is Warfret Tales so important?
Well, it wasn't a dowry for me. But so for me, unlike some various artists' compilations, this one was cool because for the most part, each band had two songs, which I thought was kind of cool. So you could hear a little bit more about what the band was. On some various artists' compilation, you'll hear one song and you'll really like it and you'll go out and you'll buy the album, and it's that album is not like that song was. So it was like a poor representation. But this one I thought was kind of cool because, like I said, for the most part, each band had a couple songs with a few exceptions. But something about it had a very DIY sound to it, where the songs sounded like they were put together really well and well written. But the production just felt so warm to me that it was really inviting. And I felt like all these people could be my friends. It just had that kind of feel to it. And that's what I think that particular sound drew me in to this album.
That's pretty cool. For me, this was really just kind of a continuation of looking into bands and a scene that I was really interested in, kind of like what Howie was saying is, and then here's this little gift. Oh, by the way, and here's a bunch of different bands that all sound really cool and a bunch of songs that you can just do, you know, get a little sample of and then go find more, you know. But one of the interesting quotes that I found that was related to the CD, the Warfret Tales Unabridged, that was later released on Avebury Records. I'm sure I'm butchering the name Avebury. Bloody hell, there's the phone. You're going to have to edit that out.
Let ring.
But it was a quote that they used from Jason Faulkner, and they said, "Liner included in this are the original liner notes from Falling James, then liner notes from Gary Stewart and Jason Faulkner," and then they put in parentheses, "Warfret Tales changed his life."
Wow.
Which I thought was amazing, because I go, you know, in the discussions that the four of us had, certain records, certain compilations, certain songs were a game changer. And it's just really cool to hear that Jason Faulkner had a similar experience. I love it.
Yeah, that's cool. I wasn't familiar with that.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
So we're going to go through and we're going to pick songs and tell why we picked the songs. I think for this particular album, Joy's probably our expert on this particular album, so we'll get the most information from her. But before we dive into it, I wanted to read the little excerpt that Falling James had written on the back of the LP, the vinyl LP. And he says, "Rock and roll is dead, 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 or so I've heard, which is very sad, I'm sure, because it's always 3 o'clock in the morning to some of us. And it gets very lonely up here. We can't sleep. The radio ain't fit company for the likes of us. So we had to make our own record. This is garage music, by the way. Raw, loud, real, and best of all, it's alive. Are you ready for Warfret? Brand new bands. 9 brand new bands. 15 brand new songs. 15 brand new drugs. And the newest and best yet from that creeping horror factory, Los Angeles. I wish some of you out there would gracefully disabuse yourself of your quaint notions regarding LA bands. Most of you ain't even been here. There are upwards of 7 million people trying to live here. That's a lot of garages. What's more, we couldn't all sound the same if we even wanted to, which, by the way, we don't. Anything can happen in a garage. Rumors of rock and roll's untimely demise have been hopelessly exaggerated. We've been here all along. I'd love to tell you that what kind of music you'll hear in this record. I wish I could tell you that this is a punk, funk, junk, pop, heavy, metal, psychedelic, blues, art, damage, reggae, electronic, acoustic, happy, rockabilly, and or this and or that compilation, but I can't. And so that's what Falling James has to say about the record. Joy, did you have any information about how the record was put together?
Yeah, I know a little bit. So it was recorded at the very first incarnation of Lyceum Sound, and that was named after the street Lyceum. And the house was, there was a house and then with a garage, and the garage had been converted into a practice studio. So Gary Stewart rented that house for the last to practice. And so Vetus and Gary are very, very intertwined within, you know, the creation of this. So basically what they did is they rented this garage and then they soundproofed it with a stinky piece of carpet that they resurrected from the Carpeteria dumpster.
Wow.
You guys remember Carpeteria. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so to record it, they had this old Docor two-reel, four-track machine, German sound machine, very, very primitive. Tony remembers going in and, you know, they played everything live, and then the only thing they did is come back and he would overdub the vocals. But it was all done reel to reel, and yeah. And then later on, and because there's no mixing board there, so later on they did any of the mixing down at the Penn household. Michael Penn had mixing equipment in his bedroom.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they did some of that. And then, of course, later on, taking the old Docorder stuff down to Radio Tokyo.
Oh, wow.
And had, yeah, yeah. And had, and then I guess Vetus was telling me that Ethan James was like, how did you even get the sound you got out of this machine?
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the recording atmosphere.
Wow.
I guess. Yeah. So that's basically how they did it.
That is so cool.
Pretty cool.
I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting because I was in a band in the 80s and we only recorded at two studios. We recorded at Lyceum and we recorded at Radio Tokyo. So our first album, the band was called White Glove Test. Our first album, Look, we recorded at Radio Tokyo. And the second one was in that garage in the backyard there. We recorded our album.
Really?
Yeah, but by then...
was the carpet stinky on the walls?
I don't remember that the carpet being stinky, but by then they had much more equipment than what you're talking about. So this must have been like the early primitive Daves, because they had, I think, a full 16-track board. And
yeah, that came later. Okay. So this was all bands, as far as I know, all the bands recorded in that garage.
Wow.
on that four-track on that four track. So
wow.
In the dope quarter. And then, you know, eventually Lyceum Sound moved and yeah, but they got better equipment. And I think they only had like three, Vetus and Tony both told me they only had like three microphones in there. And yeah, it was very, very primitive.
Wow. That's hilarious. So I say, let's go ahead and play some music. We decided to each pick a song and talk about why we picked it. Joy, did you want to start off with your pick?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I want to just talk about all of their kind of contributions and then end with the song that I picked, if that's okay.
Sure.
So the way the question got involved with this was because when Tony was 17, he was the bass player in The Last. And he was so in awe of Joe and everything Joe brought to the table, his writing, his you know, arranging, his, you know, vocals, everything. He would, you know, stand off to the side and, you know, they practiced in that garage too. So they, you know, he would go to band practice there and just watch Joe. And I teased Tony because I say you were one of the few guys that Joe didn't fire. He actually quit.
Wow.
Because Joe made him want to go and get his own band.
Wow.
Which eventually would become The Question. So, and then Vetus has always been, you know, we've all met Vetus. We know how generous he is, how nice he is. And he was always, you know, very, very supportive of anything Tony did with The Question. He, you know, produced stuff. He, you know, distributed it. Same with Gary. And that was how the question came to be on this, is from the link of the last and the fact that Vitas was like, you should be on this album. So there are three tracks from the question, two originally on the vinyl, and then when the reissue came out, the third one. So the songs are Brand New World, which was written by Tony Rugolo, David White, the drummer, and a guy that's credited as P. Conway, but I'm told that's Mark Conway, who was the first guitarist in the question. So the first incarnation of the question, Tony played bass, and then Mark Conway played guitar. He helped write that song. And then added onto the CD is a song called One More Time, which is the other side of Tony's kind of repertoire, where he goes very soulful, very gritty. He has this voice that can kind of flip-flop between Brian Wilson, smooth, sweet, and beautiful, and this gritty, soulful, and so that's One More Time. He wrote that one by himself. The song that I chose is Shall Be Love. And Shall Be Love, when the album was reviewed, it was always mentioned as a standout on there. Like, it was always mentioned. If any question song was mentioned out of the three or the two, it was this one. I think one review said it compared him, where's my writing? Oh, tricky Yardbird chord changes. And it is still the song that when you go and see them live, there's always that one dude up in front that's like, Shall Be Love, Shall Be Love. So I've gotten to the point where I know where it is in the set list, and I'll be like, it's fourth. Just to make it be quiet.
That's hilarious.
But that's my choice. I did ask him, like, you know, what inspired it, and he said, you know, it's one of those things where you look back, it's a time capsule of his life back then. And, you know, nowadays we look at it as maybe being a little corny or whatever, but, you know, those universal things of teen angst and broken hearts and all that kind of thing that that you feel as a teenager and even into your early 20s. The other thing I wanted to mention is that at this point, the question lineup was Tony on bass. Is that right? No, that's not right. Okay, the lineup at this point, at some point, Tony played some guitar on some of the recording stuff, and David said, dude, get off the bass. You need to be playing guitar. So they asked a good friend of theirs that they grew up with named Daniel Saltzman, who was like my BFF for the longest time, Daniel Saltzman to come in and play bass. And so he did on all of it except for Brand New World. And if you listen to that song, there's like this big bass thing in the middle of it. And I guess, sorry, Daniel, I guess Daniel flubbed it up. So Vitas caught it and Tony came in and redid it. And you'll hear it. It's like a whole, almost like a John Entwistle thing going there. So that's a great one to listen to. But getting back to Shall Be Love, that's my pick. It is a classic and it is probably their most popular song that people scream for.
Very cool. Let's give it a listen. Yeah, that's a great one.
So I just, to close out the question, they are working on a compilation of all of their stuff. Ooh. Demos. Yeah. The pandemic has really put the brakes on some of that. The only thing left to do really is to have Tony come in, and he's not happy with a couple of his vocals, and he's got to get that done. But then, you know, that's pretty much it, and they're ready to go. Nice. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Hopefully maybe we can do a show on that when that comes out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we'll definitely want to dig into that. So, Howie, you're up next. What song did you pick for us to listen to?
So I picked I Look Around by Rain Parade.
Ooh.
And first of all, asking any of us to pick one song off this album is just downright mean.
Yeah. But, Agreed.
It's I feel like we have to apologize to the people we didn't pick.
Exactly. But,
I love Rain Parade. This is really, it's not a great backstory or anything. I love the band. And I just, the versions on Wharf Rat are just, this almost sounds silly, but they have this garage quality to them, of course. Is there anything more literal for a garage rock description than this album?
Exactly.
The sound on that song is just, it's got a certain raw quality to it. That, and I love Emergency Third Rail Power Trip. It's one of my favorite albums of all time. And you all know I was playing it today.
Yes.
But it's, you know, it's more polished. It's got, and that kind of comes back to what you were saying earlier about Radio Tokyo and Lyceum. There's a different sound to both. And, you know, the third rail versions are more polished and slicker production, but the Wharf Rat songs are just, there's a raw energy to it that I don't even really know how to quantify it. It's just to describe it. It's just got a certain raw, youthful energy to it. And I love that song. It sounds like it could have come out in 1966.
Yeah.
That just meant everything to me, that sound, so.
Very cool. I had a question for you, Howie. So the three songs that Rain Parade did that were on the Wharf Rat Tales, on the album, it's I Look Around and This Can't Be Today, right? And those are both on Emergency Third Rail Power Trip. I was mean in having you pick one song from the compilation. I got another mean question. Which versions do you prefer? The versions from this compilation or the versions, the more polished versions from Emergency Third Rail Power Trip?
You know, I'll give you a different answer every time you ask me that.
Fair enough, so fair enough.
I like them both, and it's like, well, which one of your children do you like the best, you know?
Yeah.
It depends on how good they're being at the time, right?
So. Exactly.
I love them both. There's aspects I love about both. I spent some time today listening to I Look Around on Wharf Rat, and then going to Third Rail and just going back and forth listening to it both.
I did that too.
Wow.
And I was trying to listen to the differences, and I'm like, oh yeah, well, the guitar on Third Rail, this is really, it sounds like it's overdubbed and really polished and almost feels, sounds like it's backmasking here, you know, and it's, you know, and it's just not there on the Wharf Rat versions. Going back to what Joy said about the equipment, you can hear clearly on Wharf Rat, it's on much more primitive equipment, you know?
Yeah.
But something great about that. There's something just really great about that. Again, at the time in Seattle, too, when that came out, I was listening to bands like Room 9 that had that same sort of sound, and they're recording just on shoestring budgets and garages and these makeshift studios up here. And I loved that whole sound. So, yeah. So I guess I was a sort of a politician answer of not answering your question.
I wouldn't expect anything less. Yeah. All right. Well, let's listen to the song. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Good.
All right, Howie, you want to intro the song real quick and we'll give it a spin.
All right. Here's I Look Around by the Rain Parade.
Mm-hmm.
Great song, Howie. I was just noting on the credits on the album, it says that in addition to Matt Pucci, David Roback, Will Glenn, Stephen Roback, and Eddie Kawa, the drummer, that it also includes a guy named Brian Norris and Kendra Smith. That is interesting, especially in light of the conversation that we had, Soraya, with Matt Pucci about Kendra Smith being invited to be in Rain Parade.
Yeah.
So. Awesome. Great track. Thanks for bringing that one, Howie.
Jeff, you by far have the longest song.
No.
Pick for today's episode.
No.
Share with us your pick.
I picked a 1 minute song. So I picked the namesake of the band 100 Flowers, the song 100 Flowers, which is the third song on the first side of the vinyl. 100 Flowers is basically the urinal. So it's the three guys, John Talley Jones, Kevin Barrett, and Kel Johansson, those guys make up the urinals as well. And when they're the urinals, they're a little bit more punkier and then a little bit more art rock, I would say, when they're 100 Flowers. And I'm pretty sure that this Wharf Rat Tales was my first exposure to 100 Flowers. But the main record for me for 100 Flowers was Drawing Fire. That was an EP that came out on Happy Squid's record. And I bought Drawing Fire because of the fact that it was the artwork for it. So this guy named Bruce Leicher from a record label called Independent Project Records printed up these album covers on a press board, and it just has a really cool aesthetic to it, and anything that looked like that I would buy. So it looked like a press board, and he would do what they call a letterpress print on it, and that record Drawing Fire is really, really good. But this song, 100 Flowers, I thought was really cool. It's got, I just love the energy of it. Just, they cram a lot into 1 minute. And it's just fun, powerful. And I like the fact that it's the band's namesake. So 100 Flowers still plays around. Oh, and I did want to mention that John Talley Jones has also played with Trotsky Ice Pick sometimes. But usually when Trotsky Ice Pick plays, it's Danny and the Doorknobs plus John Talley Jones. John Talley Jones has also played in Danny and the Doorknobs and, of course, the urinals, and then Kevin Barrett also in the urinals, and then Kel Johansson also plays in Danny and the Doorknobs and Trotsky Ice Pick. So when we had Vetus on the show, we talked about how it's very incestual, all these bands with kind of the same players that kind of float around. So I just like that connection with all those bands. And this song, I just think, has tons of energy, and it's a lot of fun. So I'll go ahead and play it. So 100 Flowers by 100 Flowers. It's like one of those early SST records where they just hit it and quit it. They're just like, just get in, get out. And talking about getting to the chorus, right?
to quote one Michael Quercio, right. Get to the fucking chorus.
Right. So, and 100 Flowers Will Be My Garden. And then later he says, 100 Flowers Will Be My Grave. their debut record, titled 100 Flowers, has little flower icons on it, and sure enough, it's on a 10x10 grid, so you got 100 little flowers on there. So 100 Flowers Will Be My Garden, 100 Flowers Will Be My Grave, and 100 Flowers Will Be My Album Cover too. So all right, Soraya, what do you got for us?
So kind of piggybacking off of what everyone has said, and especially Howie, you know, when you talk about the energy of this record is really kind of raw. And it's really pure energy. And for me, the band that I wanted to go with was Wednesday Week.
Ooh.
So Wednesday Week has two songs on this. Boy, You Got Me Good, which, side note, the version on Warfare at Tales is a different one than what appears on what we had. But the song that I picked is Anyone Like Me, credited. The credits are Callan and Callan. But I love the vocals on this song. I love Chrissy's vocals on this. And according to the information for, and I'm using the information from Unabridged, which, by the way, is released on Everbury Records, which Kelly is founder of. So
nice.
I figure why not go to the source? So the players on this, on these two tunes, are credited as Chrissy Callan, guitar and vocals, Kelly Callan, drums, Kiel Johansson, bass, and then it also adds on with David Nolte, Steve Andrews, and Vetus Matare. So it's just an awesome song, so let's play it. Anyone Like Me?
Anyone
great track. And to think now I have that vision of this four track, this, you know, very old,
real to real
track, you know, real to real. And the sounds that Vetus is able to get out of these bands, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And thinking of Stinky Carpet, you know, from the walls, but
from Carpenteria's dumpster.
There you go. And, but I love this track. So
we need
so
to...
good, and you can obviously hear Vetus, you know,
100%.
Yeah. And you know, it's good to see Steve's name on there.
Yes,
definitely absolutely. A friend of the
David
show.
Multi, yeah, totally.
Oh yes, of course.
Another friend of the show. Yeah.
We definitely need to dig more into Wednesday Week. That is for sure.
100%. They're such a great band. Fantastic.
So there's four other bands that we did not play from this record. And just looking through the credits, one of which is, I read that little clip from Falling James, his band, The Leaving Trains, mm-hmm. which on this recording, Tom Hofer is playing bass and Tom plays in Danny and the Doorknob. So there's that connection there. Earwigs are another band on here. Also, The Point was another band that we didn't play any songs from. And Hector and the Clock Watchers and David Nolte is the bass player in there. So again, yeah. Again, interwoven. And then somehow we slipped and did not play anything by The Last. So The Last is also...
You're also Two Damascus.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people need to go and get... good luck finding the vinyl. But
yeah,
especially with the insert in it still. But
you're killing me, Joy.
Get the CD because yeah. There's stuff on there that is not on the album by the same bands on the album. And then you mentioned To Damascus. I love Night Surfing, which is an instrumental. Yeah. The Up and Out. Mm-hmm. They're so good. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's just a really good. You got to get the CD.
Yeah. And, you know, when Wharf Rat Tales on a Bridge got released on CD, it's also available on some of the streaming services. Like, it's on iTunes. So it is available for download in a digital format.
Oh.
The LP, I mean, we're talking Holy Grail Wharf Rat Tales. That original and some of the other compilations we're going to be talking about too are, I mean, record collectors have them. I know this group has them, but some of these are tough to find.
Yeah.
Very tough.
Yeah.
So thanks again, Billy Glasser.
The best story, I swear. That's the best story ever.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. That's cool. And then I think Vetus was telling me something about a compilation called Sons of Wharf Rat Tales, mm-hmm. which I think may have been a cassette only release. And I think he was mentioning something about possibly making that available as streaming or digital, possibly.
Yeah.
And I think he said it's upwards of 100 songs, maybe.
Can you imagine?
No.
No.
I mean, the unabridged CD version has 28 songs.
Yeah.
So.
But look, if someone can pull together tracks and probably has tapes and reels, it's Vetus Matare. And Vetus was passing. He's like, oh, you know, by the way, 100 times we're like, what? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, maybe one day. That's what I love about Vetus. He's just the best, I swear.
Yeah. Come on, chop chop, Vetus. Get it done.
I know, right? Stop all that other stuff you do. Give us more music.
All right. Before we close out, I think, Joy, you wanted to share something, perhaps a quote?
Well, I'm just going to paraphrase something that Gary said to sort of close it out, I guess. He called Wharf Rat Tales a gathering of friends who each other borrowed, gave back, gigged with, and they were like, hey, you know, it was hard to find members back then. And those that still remain are still friends, and many are still slogging it out today after their day jobs, still playing, and for which that we should all be grateful.
Oh, I love that. I hadn't heard that quote. I love that.
Some of it was mine, some of it was his. So, you know, paraphrasing, but yeah.
Nice.
I like it.
I like that a lot, too. It kind of reminds me of a similar communal vibe that the Paisley Underground has, in that these were bands that were friends from the same area that liked to gig and hang out together and play. So it sounded like a definite scene that these bands had all together.
100%.
Very cool. So what album do we cover next time? What's our next compilation?
Oh, folks, you got to tune in. Next one, Radio Tokyo Tapes.
Yes, I can't wait to hear it.
So this same crew, so.
So Howie, Joy, you'll come back for us next week?
Sure.
Very cool. All right, so
then. Howie, I know it's a tough pick, too, where you got to pick a song. But
I shared my favorite compilation albums with you recently, and yes. You know, Radio Tokyo was number one on the list for me, so. Yes.
That's why I can't wait for this next episode, so. Thanks, Joy and Howie, for joining us today and for continuing to enjoy musica, and join us for the next one. Jeff,
asking,
what else can we say? Gente a grubiar.
Groove on, Paisley people. Joy, bye-bye. That was super cool, Joy. I had no idea all that information about that.
Fabulous.
I left out a really good story, too. You want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay, so this has to do with the urinals. So when the urinals needed their first singles mixed, Vetus went over to Michael Penn's to do it. And they were working on it, and all of a sudden there was all this noise, and they had to interrupt, you know, their work to go see what it was. And so Michael and Vetus went over to the window in Michael's bedroom and looked out, and there was like a war movie, homemade war movie being filmed. And so it pissed Michael off. So he went downstairs, and according to Vetus, physically communicated that Sean needed to keep it down.
Wow.
Because I read a long time ago that this was like, it must have been Sean Penn, Charlie Sheen, I think Emilio Estevez. They would get together and film these war movies. And one of them became kind of like the seedling of a story that translated into Platoon.
I think they all did that stuff, because Tony, Daniel, David, these other guys that are really good friends with Tony, they all did these like Super 8 films. Yeah, and I remember they filmed one. They were down in a parking garage at UCLA. Oh, Chris Durand, who is a good friend of mine, that actually played Michael Myers in the H2O film, the Halloween H2O. Anyway. Yeah. So they used to do all of these films, and they had the camera down in the parking garage and panning up to like the entrance. So all you could see was this bright light and this, you know, shadowed figure coming down with like a fedora on, and he's kind of pimping and rolling as he's walking. He's going, all you can hear is his voice and see his shape. He's going, get out in that kitchen and rattle them pots and pans. Wow. It's Tony. And I don't remember anything else about the movie, because I know I watched it, but I remember that. I thought it was so funny.
That's hilarious.
Westerns, bank robbing. I've seen like tons of these Super 8 movies. I think they all did it back then for entertainment.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Crazy that was going on while the urinals were trying to lay down some tracks, right?
Well, it was just Vetus. It was just Vetus and Michael with the master.
Physically communicating.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I thought was
one of these.
Because Michael, I'm sure,
there's so many parallels between Seattle and LA music scenes. It just, that whole story is just, at the time in the early 80s in Seattle, there's all these little independent Super 8 filmmakers too. I'm still friends with some of them. And at the same time that all this sort of shoestring budget music's going on up here too. It just amazes me. There's so many parallels, and I, you know, all I know of the LA scene is listening to it and getting into it over the years, and the Seattle part I know firsthand, but the more I hear stories like that, it's like, wow, it's just amazing how many parallels there are.
That's cool.
And think about different actors.
Yeah.
But like, think about if back in the early 80s, if we had had the technology of now, like, you know, of like video streaming and things like, think of how close those scenes could have been, even more closer, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I look at it like that, even the early 90s.
I'm just glad there was no technology.
Yeah.
I mean, many of
no evidence, that's the word,
lack of evidence. Yeah.
As you lay still upon your bed, like somewhere out of reach. All day, all in a line, and you do what you wanted, but you do every time. And in a cloudy dream again upon your soul, a chill embrace engulfed you, rising night, your vision stole.